This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While the Al-Qaeda attacks of September the 11th came from the sky, U.S. officials and many others deeply concerned that the next terrorist attack could come from the sea. Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent William Longavisha writes that the world's oceans are wild and chaotic and increasingly beyond government control. His in-depth story called Anarchy at Sea is in the September issue of the magazine, and William Longavisha joins us now on the phone from Brittany, and welcome to Talk of the Nation. Good to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
In your article, for which you obviously did a lot of research, you write that Osama bin Laden is believed to have a fleet of old freighters known as the Al-Qaeda Navy. Tell us about that.
Well, of course, that title, that name has been vastly overused. It's not a navy. It's a collection of old freighters. I would say that that's really not the right way to look at it. But it's clear that Osama bin Laden has, to some extent, been in the shipping business, and that he has used ships for purposes other than making money, though mostly for making money. But he has transferred weapons and ammunition and maybe men around on his ships.
If there are, as has been reported, 18 to 20 of these old freighters in the Al-Qaeda Navy, why can't anybody trace them?
That's really the more interesting point. These ships exist not in a vacuum, but in the disorder of the high seas. So they fit perfectly into a much larger pattern, which makes them impossible to find, or maybe meaningless to find if you do find them. And that is that many, many ships and legitimate ships doing legitimate business on the high seas now mask their identities. It's a world of shadows, and that's really what I'm writing about in this piece.
A world of shadows where ships frequently change their names and their ports of origin, their flag of convenience.
It's a system which started, oddly enough, with the Americans, with the U.S., and in fact, really with the U.S. government during World War II, as a way of getting around our own neutrality laws in the years before we entered the war. And it blossomed afterward for free market reasons. And then started growing in the late 1980s and early 1990s in response, oddly enough, to an international effort to control it. So it grew steadily and slowly as a system, maybe nothing wrong with it, certainly very efficient from World War II on. And then as it got to be a larger and larger percentage of the ships on the high seas, the attempt to control it is where it really took off. That's what interests me.
Well, there is an organization that is supposed to monitor all this stuff called the International Maritime Organization.
The IMO, sure. Yeah, the IMO is the United Nations Maritime Branch. It's based in London, and it's a typically idealistic United Nations organization of equality of nations and all that. If you look at the IMO regulations, and they pertain mostly, at least until recently, have pertained mostly just to navigational and safety issues, you would say, hey, everything's under control, and the ownership is not a problem. All nations are equally just and forthright in their laws and in their application of the laws, and the world is fine and increasingly fine. Now, the reality is quite the opposite. Everyone is complying in name and sort of doing what he or she feels like doing, it leads to a form of chaos. Now, again, is chaos a bad thing? I think this can be argued. The free market people would say it's very efficient, and it is. But in that chaos, you can see other pathogens growing, like terrorism or piracy.
Now, in terms of terrorism, what we have seen thus far at sea were a couple of small boat attacks, one against the USS Cole, obviously killed American sailors, wounded many others. That was in port in Yemen. And then the attack somewhat later of a small boat, again the same kind of attack, on a French supertanker. Yet you described the second one, which got considerably less notice around the world than the first one, certainly here. But the second one, you say, was in a way much more sophisticated.
Well, an attack on a civilian target is in a way more sophisticated because of the response that it evokes. People in the Navy are in the war business and the war fighting business, French supertankers are not. The maritime world is really not in the war fighting business. And when you start hitting those targets, you send ripples all through international commerce, And, of course, it's a much more profound thing than just hitting a destroyer.
And so this kind of attack, everybody started worrying then, what's the next target? As you write, a cruise ship, a super tanker in the Strait of Hormuz, or perhaps something in the Strait of Gibraltar. Yet you also point out that what is most worrisome is bigger ships, freighters, either delivering a weapon or just detonating themselves in a harbor.
I think the real concern is not attacks against ships, but the use of ships to attack other targets. That's correct. And there are two ways that can happen. You can either steam a ship into a port, say Newark or almost in Los Angeles, you name it, and blow it up. The largest explosion in peacetime of, or one of the largest at least, was in Halifax Harbor in 1917. Two ships ran into each other and blew up and killed thousands of people and leveled the city. There's a huge explosive potential in, because of the size of these ships, even if they're just carrying chemicals, let alone actual devices. The other concern, and it is a still larger concern, is that the ship will contain, and specifically in a container, another type of device, say a nuclear device or something like that, a weapon of mass destruction, which will be brought into, through the chaos of the sea, inevitably, unstoppably, really, into either a European or a U.S. port, and then go overland with all the accuracy of the most precise guided missile to whatever target you want, anywhere on the continents, and explode it there. I mean, that's, I think, the real concern, and certainly I'm not saying anything that's not widely known as a problem, and it proves to be very, very difficult to fight against if you take on the problem directly. And I'm explaining in this article, in a much larger way, why it is so difficult to take on. And you have to understand the context of the ocean to understand why it is that conventional governmental responses are not going to work and have not worked.
We're speaking with William Longavisha, a correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly magazine, about his article in the new issue of the magazine titled Anarchy at Sea. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. We'd be particularly interested with people who have worked in the shipping business, spent time at sea on commercial tankers or commercial ships, or served on American naval vessels trying to patrol those waters. And William Longavisha, you said the context of the ocean is important to understand this. Most people simply do not understand just how big it is.
Right, right. That is the number one fact of the ocean, is that it is really big. It is, I mean, you can take all of the continents of the world and drop them into the Atlantic Ocean. It will fit, more or less. And that leaves the rest of the world for just salt water. And that's the reality of the dimension. There are storms in the ocean, and the storms are way beyond human control. The storms sink ships on a very regular basis, and big ships and small ships and good ships and bad ships. And this is going on all the time. We are not the masters of the ocean on a natural level, on a physical level, on a regulatory level. It's a very large and wild place.
You talk about the context includes the amount of shipping that goes on, and the United States is, I guess, the world's biggest importer and one of its biggest exporters as well. You tell the story, just by way of illustrating how difficult it can be to control this traffic, of a man who was found inside a container, one of the containers that were shipped all over the world, a guy known now as Container Bob.
Container Bob, of course, well-known character by now, and who knows what his real story was, but he was found by port police in southern Italy inside a container headed for Nova Scotia, and in fact headed for Halifax. He was apparently drilling holes to increase his ventilation because he wasn't quite comfortable. But in any case, they heard noises from this container. When they opened it up, out stepped the man, who was well groomed, well shaved, and inside the container he had a bed, a chemical toilet, satellite phone, computer. I mean, it was very well equipped and comfortable. He had a little heater in there. So the man was well-dressed, and he said, he didn't really give a reason. He was arrested, of course. His attorney then said that he was just trying to get away from his brother-in-law in Cairo, and he was headed for Canada. He had all sorts of documents, some false, some not false, allowing him access to airports in Canada and the United States. And he was released on bail by the Italians and disappeared.
And just disappeared?
Disappeared.
Not to be found again?
That's right, yeah.
Do we know if he paid that lawyer who served him so well?
Oh, I hope he did. I assume that he was. You know, he paid him, yeah.
Let's get some listeners involved. Matthew joins us on the line from St. Louis.
Hi there.
Hi.
I think that there are many things that terrorists can use in our societies to big attacks. I think there are many things that people could do to kill other people. And I don't think that anybody is really that naive to think that that's not the case. And I think that this is some pretty serious sort of, it seems like a very serious attempt to oversensitize the American people and the people of Europe. And I wonder if you can comment on that.
I'm just trying to get it clear, Matthew. Are you worried that this is alarmist?
Yes, I think it's alarmist, exactly.
Okay. William Longavisha?
Well, I think that you have to take the entire article and read it in context and then judge whether you think it's alarmist. Actually, I don't feel completely alarmed by this personally. I'm describing a situation which is the reality of the ocean in all of its chaos and wilderness. In response partly to what the U.S. government is doing, I'm responding partly to initiatives in this piece by the Department of Homeland Defense and the Coast Guard and others to increase the security of American shorelines at some considerable cost. And what this article is pointing out is that this is a very inefficient, at the very least, very inefficient hope that you can secure the coastlines of the United States or of Europe with these initiatives. Now, is that an alarmist thing to say? I really don't think it is.
I think that it's equally as difficult to secure our power systems and our other natural systems, our water systems, and things like that. I mean, and I don't think that anybody is unaware of that. And I think that living life is, you know, these are the dangers that happen, and I think that there's a big interest. The federal government seems to have a really big interest in raising the hair on everybody's necks about this stuff, and it's really, you know, it's no different than any other time. And I think that our government wants to go to war, and I think that that's exactly what they're doing by sensationalizing these things.
Okay, Matthew, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it. We're speaking with William Longavisha, the national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. His new article, just out in this month's issue of the magazine, is called Anarchy at Sea. It begins, "The sea is a domain increasingly beyond government control, vast and wild, where laws of nations mean little, and secretive ship owners do as they please, and where the resilient pathogens of piracy and terrorism flourish." You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller. Mike is on the line from Chicago.
Hello.
Hello, Mike.
Hi. I used to, a few years ago, fly in P3s. I don't know if your guest speaker there realizes what those are. Those
oh, sure, I do. Yeah, absolutely. I know they are.
P3 Orions, they're
sure.
Maritime search.
Patrol airplane.
Right. I used to fly in those as a radar and electronic countermeasures operator, and our main job was anti-ship and anti-submarine, but our secondary, which was almost a primary job, was tracking all the ship traffic within, like, the Sea of Japan was one of our patrol areas, down around the Philippines, down in that area. And we used to have books on every ship. They used to track their movements. We were primarily tracking, at that time, Soviet freighters. Small freighters were used as intelligence ships. So they were tracking every freighter, every ship that came along. And you can let them slip through. There's a lot of ship traffic. But I don't think a lot of people realize how large a network the Navy has set up and how complete a blanket it has on tracking ships that don't even cross into our international boundaries.
William Longavisha, you write that the officials that you talked to spoke of this problem as if it was almost hopeless.
What they say is this: look, we know that what we're facing here, and they say this off the record, they're not going to say this on the record, what we're facing here is an intelligent opponent. And if you can say, let's just look at commercial shipping and not talk about terrorism. Let's just talk about the attempt to regulate safety on ships, the old IMO thing. You're not dealing with a 1,000-year or 100-year flood here. You're dealing with a very intelligent opponent who has motives which may or may not be good. And that person is going to be adaptable. I think there's a wide recognition among officials who are actually having to grapple with the realities out there that this is true. And this explains why it is that the cathedrals of regulations that we build and even the technology of surveillance, electronic surveillance, are extremely limited in their ability to harness, to control and rein in the sea.
Let's get another caller. Dan is with us now from Monmouth, Oregon.
Yes. Actually, I just want to the first comment on what was just said. The Navy, of course, the government has satellites up in the sky to monitor ships and stuff, but there's so many commercial freighters out there that we can't really spend our resources tracking all of them. You just can't do that.
And what's your experience?
I was 10 years in the Navy as a navigator. One of the interesting things was there was a publication called Weekly Notice to Mariners, and in it, every week, you'll see ships have been sunk, people washed overboard, whatever. We cross the Atlantic every year, and if we were lucky, we might see one other ship. If we got another ship on radar, we'd go and investigate who they were. And, you know, it's just bizarre. And you're in the Atlantic. You can hide there so easily. And even once you're inside the Mediterranean, it's hard. You can go a couple of days without seeing another ship.
And that is true even if you're sitting in an airplane. I mean, the airplane does expand the horizon, but the ocean is so much larger. Of course, satellite surveillance, true. But what do you see? You see a ship. And unless you know a lot about that ship and really have actually probably gone inside it and inspected it, you really can't do much with that information. Now, there are some exceptions, but as a general method of operating, satellite surveillance and long-distance surveillance doesn't do a lot of good. I mean, the U.S. Navy has intercepted over the past few years, has actually intercepted and boarded about or over 200 ships on the high seas in the attempt to find al-Qaeda-type terrorists. Those boardings have amounted to practically nothing. I think there were four al-Qaeda operatives who were found in a big operation in the Persian Gulf some years ago. But basically, these inspections, which are not made at random, but they're made for some kind of reasonable reason, have not turned up anything. That just goes to show that an external view of a ship, even of a suspect ship, may not be good enough.
William Longavisha, thank you very much.
Thank you.
William Longavisha's article in the Atlantic Monthly is Anarchy at Sea. He also tells a harrowing story of survival and wreck at sea and a story of modern-day pirates. We'll be back with Professor Paul Wilkinson and talk more about terrorism. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.